Hey, good morning to everyone. Last week, we covered the important topic on the relationship between teacher and the student or disciple. So you may remember we touched on the advantages of relying on a teacher, the disadvantages of not relying on a spiritual teacher, or not relying on the teacher in a proper sense. And then we touched on the very important aspect on the qualities to look for in choosing a teacher, and also the qualities of a good student. And finally, we touched on how to devote oneself through thought and deeds to one's teacher. Today, we continue with the preliminaries, and we're going to combine session 5 and 6, covering the topic on the optimum human rebirth and on the three scopes or three levels of spiritual practice. So we are going to cover the topic on identifying the optimum human rebirth, firstly, and then contemplating about the benefits of the optimum human rebirth, also contemplating about how difficult it is to obtain the optimum human rebirth. And then we will touch on the three scopes of spiritual practice. So firstly, let's talk about optimum human rebirth. There are two sources that describes the optimum human rebirth. Both are used in the Lamrim. First category is the eight freedoms. That is to be free from the eight states unfavorable for Dharma practice. And then secondly, the 10 endowments. We will touch on this later. So on the eight freedom, it comes from Nagarjuna's work. And in verses, it reads like this: upholding wrong views, being an animal, hungry ghost, or being born in hell, being without a victor's teachings, being born in a remote place, or as a barbarian, as an idiot or mute, as a long-lived god. So actually this describes the eight, but the verses below continue like this: any one of these is one of the 840 or unfavorable states. Because you have gained a favorable state, free of this, strive to prevent yourself from being born in this ever again. So let us now go to the list. You also have this in your handouts. So of the eight unfavorable states that we try to be free from, there are four. So we must try to be free from four of unfavorable non-human states. And they are to be born in hell, in the hungry ghost, in the animal realm. And this, I think, you can understand quite easily. Because to be born in any one of these three lower realms suggests that you are going to have to endure great sufferings. And then the fourth, to be free from being born as a long-lived god, might surprise you. After all, the merits of God, of beings in the heavenly realm or the devas, aren't they greater than a human? So this is a very important point that we have to take note. From the Buddhist point of view, although the merit of the heavenly realms are higher than human, the Buddhist teaching consider human rebirth as a more precious. From the standpoint of the human realm, it's a mixture of in terms of the six realms, we don't suffer as much as the three lower realms. But at the same time, we avoid excessive enjoyments of the heavenly realms. So with that, we are motivated to practice. You can even take the analogy of human birth, where you are born in a very, very rich situation. So chances of someone who is very rich enjoying all the material wealth to have an interest in the Dharma is rather slim. For example, if you were to ask someone very, very rich, really enjoying all the material wealth, to come to a class like this is not easy. So human realm is more balanced, and from that point of view, it is more favorable. It is considered as a precious, considered as an optimum. Then there are four others that we try to be free from. That is to be free from the four unfavorable human states. So now that we are born a human, there are also four unfavorable human states. The first being born in a remote or in a barbarian region. So if you don't have a culture, it is not possible for you to learn and practice the Dharma. Secondly, to be born in a place where a Buddha has not come. Now, even in our world today, there are countries that are not remote or primitive in culture. For example, look into the Islamic countries. So you are not even allowed to bring any Buddhist books, any literature to these countries. So if you are born in a country like that, then there is no chance to come into contact with the Buddha's teaching. And then thirdly, to be born not possessing all the faculties of body and mind, that is a physical or mentally handicapped. Actually, if one wish to enter the monastic order, one cannot do so if one has this particular fault, that we are physically handicapped or mentally handicapped, then you cannot join the monastic order. And then finally, actually in Nagarjuna's letter, this is placed as the first. That is to say, being a person with grossly distorted attitudes and beliefs. Now this is worse than having no beliefs, because you have, it says, grossly distorted beliefs and attitudes. And actually, our world today is not free from this. It's actually full of this. There are teachings that, if you are not careful, appear like a Buddhist. Some of the people, they use Buddhism as a camouflage, but they are teaching something else. So you have to be extremely careful about this. So if we are free from eight of these, then we should consider ourselves as being a very fortunate. Then let us go on to another source that describes the optimum human rebirth as having 10 endowments, and this comes from the work titled Shravaka Leva. And the verse reads like this: being a human being and born in a central land, having all one's organs, not being perverted by the heinous crimes, and having enduring faith. Okay, some of you are taking down the notes. So let me just go to the five personal endowments. So 10 endowments are divided into category of 5 personal endowments and 5 endowments relating to others. So you have got here, firstly, being a human being, and then being born in a central land. Being born in a central land means being born in a place or a country where the Buddha's teaching is being taught, and that you can learn the Buddha's teaching. And then having all one's organ from birth. Fourthly, not being perverted by heinous crimes. So what do we mean by this? There are five of these. One is killing of one's own mother, killing of one's own father, and killing sage, that is to say killing an arahant. And then there is no possibility of killing a Buddha. But the fourth category says causing the Buddha to bleed. Like if you read the life history of the Buddha, Devadatta had done that. He had tried to, he wanted to take over the leadership of the Sangha. So he tried in various attempts to murder the Buddha and was not successful. But in one of the attempts, he released a big rock down the slope when the Buddha was walking below. And that caused the Buddha to bleed. It did not kill the Buddha. And that is considered a very serious crime. And then lastly, to cause disharmony in the Sangha. And this we have to be more careful, because if we are not careful, we are capable of doing this. To cause the disharmony amongst the Sangha. In a narrow sense, the Sangha are the monastic. In the higher sense, it refers to Arya Sangha, the assembly of the holy ones. And then the monastic Sanghas. And one can do that as a Sangha member or as a lay person, can cause disharmony in the monastic Sangha. And then in a wider scope, the word Sangha can include all the fourfold assemblies, including the laity. So if you cause a disharmony in a Buddhist organization, that indirectly is also causing disharmony in the Sangha. Okay, so these are the five so-called heinous crimes. And then fifthly, to have enduring faith in the scriptures and in the Buddhist scriptures, classified into three baskets or the Tripitaka. That is to say, Vinaya, Sutta or Sutra, and Abhidhamma. And then the verse continues like this: a Buddha has come and taught the Dharma. The teachings remain and are followed, and others generally have love in their hearts. So this refers to five others category. That is the five endowments relating to others. And they are that when a Buddha has manifested, and not only manifested, when that Buddha has taught the way, and also when the teachings are still flourishing. So we fortunately still live in an age where the Buddha's teaching is still flourishing in different places, different countries in the world. And not only that, when followers of the teachings still exist. And then finally, having the compassionate help of others in one's Dharma study and practice. That is to say, when we are studying the Dharma, when we are practicing, there are others who are very compassionate, trying to help us in the various ways. So these are the 10 endowments. You have them in your notes, the handouts. So you might have noticed that there are overlaps between these two lists, that is the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. Not surprisingly, because they come from two sources. But in the Lamrim, these two are put together because there are items unique in one, which is not found in the others. Otherwise, it will be necessary just to use one of the list, which is more complete. Okay, so now that we have an understanding of what is meant by optimum human rebirth, as described in being free from the 8 unfavorable states, And also, conversely, to be endowed with the positive qualities. We go on next to contemplating about the benefits of the optimum human rebirth. So if we have all the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments, we already have an optimum human rebirth. And the benefits is simply that we are able to practice at any level we desire. And firstly, ability to practice to attain higher rebirths. This in the Lam Rim is the initial stage. And then to attain liberation from samsara, to attain nirvana. So this is the intermediate state. And then finally, to attain a perfect Buddhahood. So this we are going to come back and talk about the last part of today's session. In other words, it is with the optimum human rebirth that we can practice so that we can determine our future rebirth, at least initially aiming at a higher rebirth and not falling to the lower realms. And this only human can do, only with the optimum human rebirth we can do. You can't even do that when you have when you are born in the heavenly realm, less so if you are born in the lower realms. So this is really how precious the human, the optimum human rebirth is. So we have to now go on to contemplate about how difficult the optimum human rebirth is to acquire. I think you can add the word human rebirth. So we can cover this in 3 aspects. Firstly, thinking about the causes for it being so hard to acquire. So what do we mean by that? Your optimum human rebirth, which could be most beneficial, is extremely difficult to acquire. You do not receive it over and you do not receive it again and again. You have been lucky by virtue of your merit and the prayers you made. It will be difficult to receive that optimum human rebirth in future. So you must understand that we now have an optimum human rebirth. It's not by accident. It is what you planted in your previous lives. That is the good causes you planted in your previous life. So you obtain that optimum human rebirth. And if you do not plant that seed again for that optimum human rebirth, then there is no hope for you to gain this optimum human rebirth again in future. So it says, hoping for a resulting optimum human rebirth when you do not have causes to receive it is like hoping for a harvest of barley in autumn when you planted the seeds of poisonous plants in spring. Because the Buddha's teaching talk about cause and effect. Without cause, you cannot get the effect. So, secondly, we can use 2 analogies to contemplate, to make us realize how difficult this optimum human rebirth is acquired. The first analogy or parable is grass on the roof. So, rebirths into the upper realms are generally as frequent as grass that grows on the mountain slope. Now, of course, rebirth in the upper realms is rarer than rebirth in the lower realms, but this is not what we are talking about. If you consider the rebirths in the upper realms, which include human, and human are not necessarily optimum human rebirth. So if you fail in any of the 18 criteria, then you have a human rebirth, but not optimum human rebirth. And then rebirth in asuras, the demigods, or the heavenly realm, the deva realm. You add all this up, it says it's as frequent as the grass that grows on the mountain slope. But a an optimum, I think we have to put an optimum human rebirth. Or here it says, a human rebirth with all the freedoms and endowments is extremely rare. As rare as a blade of grass on the roof of houses. And then I think the second analogy you are more familiar with, this is the neck of a turtle. The neck of a turtle means this. Suppose there is a golden yolk floating on the ocean, being blown by the wind. The yolk has only one hole, and a blind turtle living in the ocean pokes its head out of the ocean's surface once every 100 years. The turtle's head would probably not come up through the yolk. So the chances of that happening is so extremely small. It's smaller than, I think many of you are more familiar with striking a lottery. When something very rare happens, you say, oh, it's rarer than striking a lottery. So this is even rarer than striking a lottery. The chances is so slim. Of course, one cannot claim that the yolk and the turtle will never meet. But this is very nearly the case. Like, we cannot say you can never strike a lottery, otherwise nobody will buy one. But you know the chances is very small. And yet receiving an optimum human rebirth is even rarer than this blind turtle's head coming up to the surface of the ocean and just hit the hole in that golden yolk. So this is how difficult it is to obtain that optimum human rebirth. Okay, thirdly, we talk about the nature of the difficulty of acquiring it. So firstly, many beings are practice non-virtues. Few practice virtues. So sentient beings include all the beings in the six realms. So when beings live their rebirth in the higher and lower realms, the vast majority go to the lower realms. Because most of the time, even as human, we are overcome by greed, anger, ignorance. And then in the other realms are no better, probably worse. So because we are plant the seeds of our unvirtues, so we are born in the lower realms, not surprisingly. Then secondly, we can contemplate like this. Among the six types of rebirth, that is to say the six realms, there are generally very few beings who are human. So you don't even have to look at the six realms because we don't have the capability to see the heavenly realm, the deva, the hell realm, the hungry ghost. But we can see the animal realms. So there are animals living in water, on the land, and then flying. So if you look at just the population of animals compared with a human, just think like that. If you sometimes just take example of small insects, so the insect could easily, in terms of population, be more than a human. I used to spend a long time in New Zealand, and when I was there, we always joke with our New Zealand friends because they have a human population of that time about 3 to 4 million. And in New Zealand, for sheep alone, they have something like 50 million sheep. And then we say, fortunately, the sheep don't have a voting right, otherwise they will be outvoted, human will be outvoted. So you can contemplate like this. And then even among human rebirths, you are born as a human. It is extremely rare to be born when Buddhas come to the world. Imagine the time when Buddhism, the Buddha's teaching is not in the world. Now, there are previous Buddhas, their teachings last for some time, after that, no more. So when it comes to our own Buddha, teaching of the previous Buddha was already lost, no more. And then our Buddha appeared, yeah, and attained perfect Buddhahood, and then taught, and then we have the Dharma. But prior to that, there's a dark period, yeah, no Buddha's teaching. So here it says, even among human rebirths, it is extremely rare to be born when Buddhas come to the world. So when you put all this together, you can realize how difficult it is to be, to attain this optimum human rebirth, and therefore how precious it is. Sometimes we take this for granted. We have the most precious thing in the world, and then we are not aware of it. In the Lotus Sutra, there is a parable of a poor man, very, very poor. He had to beg for his food. And one day he met with a good friend who was very rich. And then the rich man tried to help him and firstly gave him food to eat. And then he got drunk because he never had such good food, you know, and also liquor. So after he got drunk, this rich man had to go to another place. So he decided to help this poor man by tying on his garment a very precious jewel, hoping that the second day he would discover this and be free from the poor state forever. So he went away, and then many, many years later, he met this poor friend who was as poor as before. And then he was very surprised. He asked him, "How come, you know, a few years ago when we met, I gave you a precious jewel, but because you were drunk, I tied it on your garments. How come you are still so poor?" And then they found that, you know, all the time this poor man was carrying this most precious jewels, but he thought that he was very poor, and then continued to go begging for food and live in great hardship. So we have to realize the preciousness. So with the precious human rebirth, we can practice. We can practice on three levels. So let's look at this. We can practice the initial scope. And by this we mean we take up ethical practice. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. So if we plant the good seeds, then we can be assured of a higher rebirth. Rebirth again as human or in the heavenly realms. So this is the initial scope. And then secondly, the intermediate scope. If we go beyond that, then we realize that the higher realms not ultimate. And then when we exhaust the merit in these respective realms, then we have to still continue go round and round in samsara. So then we develop renunciation. We make a strong resolution to get out of samsara, so we can be freed from samsara. So this is the intermediate scope. And then finally, we develop renunciation, try to be free from samsara, but then we realize that all sentient beings also wish to be free from sufferings. And in the ultimate sense, only after you get out of samsara are you truly free. Okay, so truly free from sufferings. And then you contemplate that all these sentient beings had been your own mother before. So you, through gratefulness, you contemplate that you cannot do this alone. You cannot allow sentient beings to continue to go around samsara because they still have ignorance, hatred and greed. So you develop bodhicitta. You decide to help them. You decide to aim for perfect Buddhahood, because only a Buddha can help sentient beings. So this is the final scope. And actually the Lamrim teaching tries to get all of us to adopt this as our goal. That is to attain the Buddhahood, to tread the Bodhisattva path. But in order to do that, we need to plant the foundation. That's why we say initial scope and we say intermediate scope. So if after thinking about the difficulty of obtaining this most beneficial optimum human rebirth, you develop a wish to extract some essence from it, you should train your mind through the three scopes of the Lamrim, what we have described just now. If we want to achieve Buddhahood, we must first develop realization into the earlier sections of the path. That is the two foundation. That is the initial and the intermediate. So when we speak of the initial and intermediate scopes, we mean training the mind in the states of the path shared with the initial and intermediate scopes. We do not mean training the mind in the actual initial and intermediate parts of the path. So what do we mean by this? Of course, there are people who only want to aim for the initial path. They only aim to attain higher rebirth. They don't care for Nirvana or Nibbana. So, okay, they can do that. But hopefully after they have done that, they decide to go further. So if they are only doing that, then we consider this as taking the initial path as the end by itself. So here we are saying that the initial and the intermediates are not ends in themselves, but means to the final end. Okay, so that's why we distinguish between capital I and small I. So to make it maybe easier to understand, let's use this analogy. Three persons are traveling by road. One going to Singapore, one going to Kuala Lumpur, and one going to Ipoh. If you don't like these three places, you replace the three places that are more familiar with. So we know Singapore is furthest away from Penang. We are talking about from Penang. And then Kuala Lumpur, and then Ipoh. So one of these three only wish to go to Ipoh. So he has to travel that path or the road from Penang to Ipoh. The stretch of the highway. And then the second person wish to go to Kuala Lumpur, then continues with the road from Ipoh to Kuala Lumpur. And then that's enough for him, he stops there. But the third person continues his journey from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore and ultimately reaches Singapore. So for this person who has to travel to Singapore, he still has to travel the shared path from Penang to Ipoh first. This is called the initial path. And also the shared path from Ipoh to Kuala Lumpur. This is the intermediate. But then he alone travels the unique, not shared, path from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore. This is what is meant by shared and unshared. That is the unique path of the Bodhisattva. So it is very special. It is very unique from that sense. And ultimately, in the Lamrim teaching, we are taught to make that the ultimate goal. So the important lessons to take here is that you cannot think in terms of taking shortcut. So without the foundation of the initial scope, if you don't even know how to practice as a decent human being, then there is no chance for you to be free from samsara. It's not possible at all. And then if you don't have renunciation, some people think that they can develop bodhicitta without renunciation. This is absurd. Without renunciation, there is no bodhicitta. So because you have to have that as a foundation to that final stage. So it is like this: when we have a building, we need to have the foundation. And the foundation are of two parts. So when we talk about the preliminaries, let's consider this building. So we are now on the main prayer hall. This is the highest, and we like this. This is probably a very nice prayer hall. The prayer hall sits on so many other floors below. And this is what you can see. What you cannot see are the foundations. So the piling that was done, that's the preliminaries. And then there are foundations, what you call the pile caps, you know, this is in construction term. And also the ground beam is also buried below the ground. You don't see them today. They are the initial scope of practice. Very important foundation. And then the lower floors refer to the intermediate scopes. So this is the Buddhist parable of not trying to build a penthouse without lower floors and without foundation, because then it just isn't possible to do that. So we have to realize that this is so for our spiritual practice. Okay, so I have actually tried to cover these three scopes very, very briefly, because from here on we will go to the three scopes, starting with the initial scopes, and then the intermediate scope, and then the final ones. This will be the topics for our future lessons.